Good morning. I'm Sarah Mendelson. Welcome to CSIS. I ask all of you that if you do have cell phones, please turn them off. On behalf of both CSIS and RFERL, we are very pleased to see you all here today. We have lots of propaganda and articles out front for you to grab. Before we begin, I want to make one announcement, which is that tomorrow morning, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty is going to have a briefing on Turkmenistan today. That's from 9 to 10:30, and their location is 1201 Connecticut Avenue. So you can put that on your calendar. It is a great pleasure for me to be joined here by these two young but longtime friends of mine. For those who don't follow human rights issues in Russia every day, these two people are among the best and the brightest of a young cohort of Russian human rights activists that will take the human rights movement in Russia well into the 21st century. And when you hear people say that there is no civil society in Russia, I want you to think of these two people who are on the front line every day. We are very lucky at CSIS to be involved with both of them in various different ways. At CSIS, we've overseen a series of opinion surveys in Russia concerning how Russians think about a variety of issues, including on human rights, democracy, authoritarianism, Stalin, the war in Chechnya, abuse in the army, by the police, issues related to HIV/AIDS, and other health matters. And over the years, we've had numerous meetings with both Yuri and with Tanya on issues relating to these issues, and we hope very much in our planned future work that our data will be useful to them. At the moment, rather than thinking very much about the Russian population, unfortunately, we all seem to be fairly obsessed with presidents and prime ministers. In other words, the upcoming G8 meeting. For several months, there has been enormous discussion and debate transatlantically, over email, on phones, in meetings, about what should happen in the lead-up to the G8, what sorts of meetings should occur to try and affect the discussion and the agenda, what issues are most pressing. And there are numerous perspectives on this. Where to place the issue of human rights issues in Russia on the agenda, which specific aspect of human rights issues in Russia should take precedent. I want to argue, as a way of a lead-in, that there are, in fact, in the Euro-Atlantic region, we are having a bit of a crisis of human rights. We have, and by we, I think there are, it's not just about Russia, it's about the United States, it's about the UK. We have rather fecklessly downgraded human rights in our own quest for greater security, and that this is a false trade-off. Nowhere is this more obvious than on issues related to torture. From my perspective, it seems harder and harder for the U.S. or the U.K. to discuss disappearances or torture, whether in the North Caucasus or the Fergana Valley. The credibility has decreased, and this affects all of us. So to what extent should we be pushing a discussion of these larger issues of human rights and security that we are all facing and do not, frankly, yet have answers for? And how do we most effectively at the same time address a very important series of human rights issues inside of Russia, where the situation is quite perilous? We have to do many things at once. Most worrisome in many ways is the recent legislation adopted in April concerning the registration and conduct of NGOs in Russia. In many ways, this so-called NGO law is an outlier in legislation around the world, despite the efforts of the Russian government to convince you otherwise. But there are other areas we might touch on, such as a new terrorism bill, which was recently adopted. The situation in the North Caucasus, inside Chechnya, but as well in other parts of the North Caucasus, we see increasingly amounts, different kinds of violence, and we worry that those situations, the violence, will join up and that we'll be in a situation of essentially a full-scale war. We see an increase in hate crimes. We could also mention the situation inside the army and army abuse, which Yuri has worked so long and hard on. The list is indeed long, and how do we prioritize, and what can we, in the rest of the G7, help and do about it? So I'd like to ask Tanya and Yuri to give their perspectives on a series of questions. you have the ability to write the talking points for folks going into the meeting with President Putin. What would you like the G7 leaders to discuss with President Putin? What is the message that you would most like delivered? And where would you sit on the issue of pushing Russia in fearing perhaps a pushback from President Putin? Or do you think it's better to discuss issues that relate to us all? In other words, how to prioritize the problems inside of Russia versus the issues that we're all facing. And what meetings have you, I know both of you have been involved in trying to figure out the best way to raise both these kinds of issues that affect us all and issues that are Russia-specific. If you think back to a year ago when the G8 was in London and there was this, you know, there were rock concerts and there was, you know, global television. I think I sat and watched TV all day to see the debt campaign. There's an enormous amount of pressure when these G8 meetings move around, and next it will be in Germany. For the NGO communities to really affect the agenda, and it's an enormous opportunity, but it is an enormous amount of pressure. So what meetings have you organized and why, and what do you hope to gain from these? And how do we continue the conversation post mid-July when all the issues that we're talking about continue to exist, but the attention of the world has moved on to other things? So I'm going to ask Yuri to speak first, and then we'll go to Tanya, and then we will go to you for questions. Thanks.
Oops. Thank you very much, Sarah, for this very kind introduction. And thank you, CSIS and Radio Free Europe, for hosting this event. Well, the messages that we would like the leaders of G7 to convey to President Putin and the Russian people. One would be, one recommendation would be that it should not be just a message from President Bush alone. We strongly believe that the conversation with Russia, critical dialogue, should be conducted by the leading democracies together. Unilateralism being a general problem of the U.S. foreign policy also seriously undermines our work. The Russian political community, the Kremlin, has been quite successful in portraying to the Russian people the criticism of human rights and democracy in Russia as aimed at weakening and undermining Russia as something of a tool of American foreign policy for American own interests, driven not by the true concern about the life of Russians, but about American interests, aimed at making Russia weak. Well, we want Russia to be strong. We want Russia to be a leader on the international community, but a leader being a country that actually leads in promoting freedom and democracy, not feared because of weapons as in the old times, or because of the oil and gas dependency, a country that is built on democratic institutions and guarantees the highest international standards of human rights, where people can freely speak their minds, organize, associate, use free media, compete in the public and political sphere, and are respected by the state. Unfortunately, in the recent years, we have witnessed a dramatic setback in democratic institutions and human rights in Russia. And ironically, this year, Russia is not only the host the chair of the G8, but also the chair of the Council of Europe just a few days ago, a week ago. So it has become assumed the chairmanship of the Council of Ministers of the Council of Europe, having not fulfilled a whole list of obligations it has taken, it took when it joined the Council of Europe. So we believe that the St. Petersburg Summit provides a unique opportunity for the world-leading democracies to tell Russian people that they want Russia to be prosperous, to be in the club. But in order to be in the club of leading nations, Russian government has to be following the democratic criteria, has to play by the democratic rules. Back in the 90s, Russia was invited, became a member with a hope, with understanding that it's moving in this direction, but it's not really there yet. Sort of an advance invitation, if you wish. Well, as I said, we believe that it not only has not moved, but actually is moving backwards in many ways. So the message should be not coming from the United States alone. It should be not clearly articulated in a way that it's not taken by the Russian public as anti-Russian, as aimed at weakening Russia, but the other way around, as aimed at making Russia more prosperous and stable, peaceful and democratic. And finally, that Russia, if it wants to stay in the club, has to play by the democratic rules. That's the framework. And there is a number of concrete items on the agenda, many of which Sarah listed in her opening remarks. Since we want to be short in our initial presentations and then discuss, have a chance to talk to you in a dialogue mode, I skip the part of which of the items are of a global nature and which are of a more kind of Russia focused importance, but a few words about what civil society is planning to do, what we are working on these days. We really believe that it's not only a meeting of seven men and one important woman, but actually it should be also a meeting of civil societies. Well, there are several initiatives underway, with a whole range of options, if you wish, because civil society is different from governments in a way that it's pluralistic, and some are more willing to work with the state, with the government, even when it's not democratic and undermines human rights. See the value in dialogue and cooperation. Others don't and believe that it's important to raise a strong voice of opposition to show the world and the Russian public that there is an opposition, that there is other Russia, that there are people who seriously believe in the fundamental importance of democracy and human rights for the Russian people, are sure that it's possible, and are working hard to make it real. And there are people in our community in between, so to speak, who are not prepared either to work with the government or consider themselves an opposition. They rather focus on concrete human rights issues as activists and experts. And after all, there are also people who want to go out to the streets together with the ultra-globalists and anti-globalists to make a point about big global issues, global poverty, global warming, the deafness of the world governments to the plight of the people across the world. So that's our menu, if you wish. Some, including myself, are engaged in all of these activities across the spectrum because we see, well, I personally see the value in each of them and limitations as well, and are trying to use each and every opportunity to get our message across. There is the so-called civil G8 process coordinated by the chair of the Presidential Council on Human Rights and Civil Society, Ella Pamphilova. In place since December last year, with the International Advisory Council and a national working group made of some 10 Russian NGO leaders, including myself. And there will be an NGO forum in early July made of a series of roundtables, including a few on human rights. So far, we have not experienced any pressure, censorship, or attempts to limit what we want to say. And many of our colleagues, including Sarah, plan to come to talk about human rights in the context of the war against terror, about internal armed conflicts and human rights, about migration and human rights, about racism and xenophobia, and about NGO legislation and NGO government interaction. Well, this civil G8 process is not focusing on Russia. It is of a global nature in its substantive scope. Russia included, but not at the center. Well, in addition to us, the independent NGOs, there will be some GONGOs, government-organized NGOs, which are growing in numbers in Russia. A lot of Kremlin loyalists, a lot of people who will come only to say that things are great. Well, we believe that we will be able to adopt meaningful documents, pass them on to the G8 leaders. The benefit of Pamphilova's process is that it has direct access to the Sherpas, who are the assistants of the leaders in this G8 process. Well, she even says that President Putin himself will come to the forum to greet the civil society. Well, it is a problem for some of us because we are there not to applaud and show support, but rather to ask critical questions and show a different opinion, show our concern about many issues. We'll see how it happens. Some may simply stand up and leave at the moment when the president comes. Well, then, on the other side of the spectrum, there is the Other Russia, or the conference called Other Russia, put together by the All Russian Civic Congress, a loose coalition of opposition democratic parties and civil society organizations in existence in December 2004, meeting approximately once a year for big gatherings, and having a few joint projects like public discussions in the regions on democracy issues, etc. It is a good occasion for this Civic Congress to get together before the G8 and show the Russian public and the international community that there is indeed other Russia. Other Russia that not only is in disagreement with the current course of developments in Russia, but more importantly does concrete work to develop alternatives in our life. Not necessarily alternative in politics. The conference is not aimed as anti-Kremlin, anti-Putin or anything, but rather a clear, strong message of the existence of a democratic community. Because many people in the world may have an impression that, you know, Russians, 70% of Russians support President and the policy of the Kremlin, and others just don't care. Well, it is difficult to show to explain that there are many people in organizations and groups who think differently and act differently. They are now marginalized. So it will be a collection of political parties, NGOs, and new grassroots social movements, like the movement to save Lake Baikal, the movement of car owners, and a number of others that have emerged in the last year or two. And there will be, in addition to conversations about freedom of speech, about the elections, about racism, xenophobia, about corruption, and other issues, the focus will be on what civil society and democratic community is doing to address these issues, rather than simply illustrating the scourges of the authoritarian regime. And there will be a big display, an exposition of activities, of the different projects and initiatives across the country. Finally, as I said, for some, either of the two options is difficult. Some feel that working in the semi-official civil G8 is too much of a compromise. For others, working with political parties with whom we have difficult history, there is a lot of mistrust. Many of civil society groups feel that they are used by political parties as electorate base without much respect as true partners. And it is really difficult to be part of the other Russia event. And therefore, we believe that we have to have our own space, our own voice, our own identity. And we are holding our own human rights NGO conference in between of these two events, where we will very much in detail look at major human rights issue in Russia. Well, mostly along the list that Sarah has provided, and develop concrete recommendations, as we have done every year. But just this time, it will be in the context of G8, and for us, it is obvious that Russia, if the criteria of holding governments accountable for their international obligations and their democratic standards would be applied consistently without double standards, Russia would not end up as a chair of G8. We are not calling for isolation or throwing Russia out of G8. No, we think that this is an excellent leverage that should be used effectively. But clearly, Russia falls far below the standards that we believe should be applied to the chair of the club. Well, here I will stop and pass on to Tanya. Thank you.
Thank you, Yuri. Thank you, Sarah. And thank you, everyone who found it possible to attend this briefing. Now, Yuri described very eloquently the major challenges in the situation in Russia today and the different meetings, the different initiatives that Russian civil society is involved in. Frankly, the situation that we are witnessing today is really, unbelievably enough, but very much of a shock to us. For years, really, we've been talking about negative developments with human rights and democracy in the Russian Federation. And all the trends were basically there, but none of us actually expected such a speedy, such a tremendous decline. And the last year, the past year, was very significant in this respect. Things started happening very quickly. Way too quickly for us to deal with them, even way too quickly for us to digest them. Now, Yuri and I are now in Washington, D.C., and we've just come from Atlanta, from a Human Rights Defenders Forum, which was organized by the Human Rights First and the Carter Center. And that's a regular event. This is the third such forum that I'm attending. And I remember quite clearly how exactly a year ago, we were talking about some very negative developments in Russia, and we were making very negative predictions. But nevertheless, what we are seeing today is very much unexpected for us. It's almost like a déjà vu. It's almost like a throwback to the Soviet time, in certain respects. Well, certainly, the Russian public supports President Putin quite a lot. And there are very legitimate explanations to that, particularly the well-being in Russia today. The well-being of the public is so much better than it used to be years ago. The buyer's capacity is very much stronger, and people, economically speaking, live a better life, live a more secure life. We can certainly talk about the oil economy and the Dutch disease and all the relevant threats, but it's there, and it's on the table. And while the Russian government does not invest in human rights, and while the Russian government does not invest in democracy, the public also, unfortunately, as a majority, does not support democracy at this point. It is partly the heritage of Yeltsin's times, the very chaotic privatization, the shock therapy reforms, the terrible financial crisis that the country suffered. And for many people in Russia today, democracy is something which just rhymes with chaos. It's a very negative word. And I think that the main task of Russian civil society is really to change that. And it's a very challenging task. But certain things that we are witnessing today really should not be happening right now. They should not be happening in Russia, who claims to be a democratic state and who is a member of the big club. I can tell you a story. In fact, it's a very personal story, and some of my friends already knew about it. When I was in school in the United States, and I was here in college and then in graduate school years ago, I worked at the Andrei Sakharov Archives, the Human Rights Archives in Boston. And that was in the 1996-1997, and I read lots of stuff, of course, about the Soviet dissent and the human rights movement and how it evolved in the Soviet Union. And for me at that point, it was really stories about gods and heroes and some very courageous people that did the impossible, that in the situation of a total lack of freedom, found so much inner freedom that they actually challenged the situation and they dared to live as free people. And reading about those people, learning about their fates, was a very important experience for me, and I kept recalling how my parents, who were really the same age, the same generation, lived their lives under the Soviets and were not part of this movement, were not even aware of what that movement was doing. And I kept thinking to myself, not that I blame my parents. They are normal people. They wanted to have normal lives. They wanted to raise their children. But it's good that there are gods and heroes, because without them, my generation would not have enjoyed the freedom that we are enjoying now. Because for me and the people my age, it was there for granted. We never thought, when I was 20, when I was 22, I never thought that I would actually live in a situation where freedom of media would be severely restricted. I never thought that I would live in a situation where independent civic activity would be severely restricted. For me, it was something of the past, a historical reality, a time to remember about, and a tale of some heroic people to always keep in mind. And then things started sliding down. I returned to Russia in 1998, and relatively soon President Putin came to power. And for a while it was a very slow slide down, and you could always say, well, this is incidental and that is incidental. But there is no free media, meaning that there is no free television, but at the same time there is internet, there is print media, you can get your stuff published, you can have a free discussion, you can have student debates, whatnot. So some space is there, some space is open. But then very slowly, this space started closing down. And today we've got a feeling that it has closed down to the point of no return. I remember that in my case, the first time when I really thought that some of the Soviet reality is coming back to us was right after Khodorkovsky was detained and put to prison. And at that time, I was director of the Moscow-Helsinki group. And I had to travel to the United States on business for about 10 days or so. And the head of the organization, Lyudmila Alexeyeva, was also traveling at the time. And most unfortunately, right after the detention of Khodorkovsky, somehow it happened that some of the human rights organizations were being visited by Federal Security Service officials. Nothing dramatic, just ask questions. No one was detained or anything, but it seemed really dangerous and really suspicious. And as the head of the organization, I was thinking, I've got to go for 10 days, and my staff is going to be left here alone. How are they going to deal with it? So what I did was actually to call a staff meeting, and I sat with my staff for about an hour, and I was telling them what to do if the FSB come. Something very generic, like never answer any questions, just say that the leader of the organization is traveling, the director is traveling, the boss is traveling, you don't know anything, you are not involved. When the boss returns, she'll be able to answer all the questions. End of story. And when I was saying it, I kept thinking, well, actually, I was lucky enough to work at the Andrei Sakharov archives because that's how I learned the tactics. And I was like, oh, my God, am I really right now, today, saying this, like, seriously, to the people that I work with? Because apparently at that time I've been involved with the human rights movement for about 5 years. And it was human rights research. It was reporting. It was advocacy. Some very respectable and understandable things. I was also doing field research in Chechnya at this point. But you thought Chechnya is really an armed conflict zone, it's different. What's happening in Chechnya is not happening in Russia. It's your personal choice. You go there. It's a risk factor, but it's a comprehensible risk factor. But how come I'm sitting here in Moscow and telling my colleagues what to do when the FSB comes? This is not normal. And that was probably the first time when I realized that things were completely abnormal. And what we see in Russia today is that the independent media is basically not there anymore. Independent political parties do not exist in the parliament. The United Russia Party, the presidential party, has the constitutional majority, any legislative initiative which comes from the president's office or is supported by the president's office is doomed to be adopted. Independent business is not there, and all the pillars of civil society are practically gone, with the exception of one, non-governmental organizations. And what we have today is the new NGO legislation. And frankly, there are thousands and thousands of NGOs registered in Russia. So what happens if five of them are shut down? The Russian government is going to say, we've got thousands of them. Five doesn't matter. But actually, it wouldn't be the worst-case scenario. I think what's going to happen is something more benign on the surface, because the government does not need to close down independent organizations. The new administrative regulations are so burdensome and so difficult and so impossible to fulfill that, in fact, it's really easy to make any NGO quit whatever it's doing, stop its work on the substance, in order to be completely preoccupied with responding to one query after another query after another query. And there is no limitation to those queries. One of the requirements, for example, which may be stipulated in the bylaws, and the bylaws are now in process of being elaborated, is that NGOs have to report on all the media coverage of their activity, including on the web.
That has been adopted.
So it has been adopted. Well, it has been adopted. I'm not sure how I'm going to do that. I don't think I have the capacity of monitoring what kind of media coverage, including on the web, my organization gets. And if you fail to report something, then there are relevant sanctions. But just about a few weeks ago, I was speaking in the Netherlands, in The Hague, to an audience of mostly parliamentarians and some acting and former ambassadors of the Netherlands to different countries. And I was describing the situation in Russia. And in the intermission, two of the parliamentarians came up to me and they said, listen, thank you, very structured presentation. You explained it very well, very trustworthy. Yes, we realize now that in Russia, President Putin has basically eliminated independent media, independent parliament, independent business, and now independent judiciary, and now he's out to get independent non-governmental organizations. Thank you for explaining that to us. But, you know, Russia is such a big and difficult country. Shouldn't we just give the guy a chance? Well, you feel relatively strange when someone actually tells you that maybe you should consider an option that another person would be given a chance to get rid of you. But that's the psychological aspect of the story. What I'm trying to say is that in this very democratic European country, the approach to the situation in Russia is generally quite inadequate. And I think that this story is very illustrative because apparently if the members of the well-established club think in that way, they compromise the very principles of the club. It's not only that Russia does not invest into human rights and democracy, it's also that the community of Western democratic states does not invest sufficiently into those same values and principles. And I very strongly believe that when Russia's European and American partners are telling us, well, we're really trying. We're trying to do something about Russia, but there is absolutely no leverage. With Europe, it's oil and gas and the energy cooperation, the energy dependence, we should call it correctly. There is absolutely no leverage. We cannot do anything. The Russians, if we are raising too sensitive issues, they're going to slam the door. I think the leverage is there. And the leverage is the club itself. It was a club initially formed without the Russian Federation. Russia was invited on board on certain conditions. All the rules are there. All the regulations are there. They are printed. They are carved in stone. What not? And I think, just to emphasize the point that Yuri has made earlier, if you want any progress at all, the entire club of democratic nations has to come forth with one and the same message. Your status in the club, your position in the club, depends on your performance. And this is something that we, not that we expect, but we want to expect from the G7. Thank you.
Questions from you all. I know I have some. Please state your name and where you're from. We have any takers? If not, yes, Elaine. So for any of you who didn't quite hear the question, on the one hand, do the Russian people essentially want a kind of dictator? And two, what is the role of socioeconomic conditions and the sort of decline in standards of life and the role of alcoholism? And how does that wedge into the human rights issue?
Well, I'll take the first question and Yuri will take the second one. Does Russia need a dictator? Do the United States need a dictator? Russia is a big and complex country. The United States also represents a very big and a very complex country. Do you guys want a dictator? I seriously doubt it. And I seriously doubt that Russian people want a dictator. But in Russia, the culture of civic responsibility is not quite there yet. I think that the Russian people are learning. And I think that what really gives us hope are all those new civil grassroots movements that Yuri was just mentioning in his presentation, the ecological movement, the movement of car drivers, whatnot. We are not talking about human rights NGOs in this situation, but people are joining in to groups to protect their interests, to protect their very concrete interests.
Student groups as well.
Student groups as well.
Local housing collectives and so on.
So that is very important. And many policymakers and many experts in the West actually believe that this regime is strong and at least it can keep the country together. But at the same time, if you take a closer look at the so-called federal power vertical, because this is what President Putin has built, you realize quite clearly that everything within that vertical is hooked directly to the president and the president's office. And when you try to imagine the Russian Federation when Mr. Putin is not there, the whole vertical just crumbles. And it may be conducive to some very tremendous chaos. This vertical does not work.
Right. Well, transition of the 90s has added to many traditional ills in Russia. Alcoholism has been around not since 91, I'm afraid. Now we have sovereign democracy, strong leader, effective, they say, governance, but we have total neglect of healthcare, complete collapse of the medical system, disregard for the HIV/AIDS epidemic, continued decline of life expectancy of men and women. So it's not really about the difference between the 90s and now. Socioeconomic issues, health problems are huge. They were there, they still are with us, unfortunately. And of course, it is part of human rights. We believe in the Universal Declaration, which says that economic and social, cultural rights, as well as civil and political rights, are all interconnected and interdependent. If you are sick and homeless, you will not go to vote. You don't care about freedom of speech. And on the other hand, if there is no independent judiciary, you cannot protect your right to work or freedom from discrimination in education. So it's a part, a big part of our human rights issues.
One of the puzzles, I think, for those of us on the outside, when we look at how, for example, we asked 1,200 Russian doctors what they thought the primary healthcare crises were in Russia. These are all people who work with HIV/AIDS. And only about 15% of 1,200 doctors thought it was HIV that was the primary, alcoholism, cardiovascular. But the amount of anger in that the respondents had at the government for not investing in healthcare was really striking. And so I think for a lot of us on the outside, it's trying to understand why, I mean, in this case, a group of doctors, but the general population is not in some ways angrier? Or why don't they translate their anger into government officials who seem to be not responding to their needs?
Well, there was one huge outburst of anger, as you remember, a little bit more than a year ago,
January,
yes, when the reform of social benefits took place. And this was the reason why the government decided to postpone a whole series of other reforms in social sphere, as they call it, housing, continuation of pension reform, healthcare, and so on, because, they want stability. And people learned a lesson, both in the 90s and in the 2000s, that they have to survive on their own, that they cannot really rely on the state, which on the one hand is part of a modern world across the globe, where you have to really develop, you know, your own networks of support and take responsibility for your own life. But there are millions of people who the government should provide with minimum standards of survival, because it is about human dignity and about human survival. And these are not taken care of.
We now have microphones, so if you can wait till the microphone gets to you.
Thank you. Tom Hambrick Stowe, Yomiuri Shimbun. One issue not talked
about. I'm sorry, one more time?
Japanese newspaper, Yomiuri Shimbun. Sorry. One issue not addressed was WTO accession. I guess I'm wondering, are these issues being addressed in the negotiations with the U.S.? What impact, if any, would it have if it's being addressed?
Well, it's the official agenda of G8 is quite limited. Human rights is not there. Democracy is not there. WTO as such is not there. Well, there are three major sort of top issues that are in the center of the agenda, which are the energy, the infectious diseases, and education, mostly professional education. And then there are a few smaller, like security and anti-terrorism. This is where we're trying to squeeze in with human rights. There is financing of development projects, including the poverty issues in Africa, pledges made a year ago. And also trade is there among smaller issues. So to be honest, civil society, at least in our sector, in the human rights, has not used the WTO negotiations to sort of use it as a leverage. However, our colleagues in the environmental community certainly are looking at this issue and are trying to address, as well as address environmental concerns, as well as people on the left side of the spectrum, of the political spectrum in Russia. Not only the old communists, but the new left, who, you know, are concerned, genuinely concerned about some of the negative aspects of globalization and open trade. And of course, there are people who exploit this, the nationalists, the conservatives, the isolationists, who exploit the fears and operate with the myths and stereotypes of enemies all around Russia who want to colonize and take over.
You might think about the fact that, we're going to start a rumor right here, if the WTO was tabled, what your response would be.
My name is Luba Wolf, and I'm with the Council for Community of Democracies. I had two questions. One was wondering if you guys could unpack the term sovereign democracy and what exactly that means to the Russian government and what it means to Russian people. And also, if you could address the issue of lack of public support for democratization, or the kind of apathy towards the subject, and what the Russian civil society can do and how international civil society and governments can help you with that specific aspect of this problem and getting the Russian public to care.
Well, thank you, Luba, for these questions. The sovereign democracy substituted recently the managed democracy as a concept for the Russian political system, essentially meaning human rights and democratic institutions are internal affairs. It allows the Russian government to brush off the outside criticism and marginalize the internal critics, portraying them as working against the interests of Russia, as traitors, as people who sold to foreign powers, or even as spies. You remember the infamous spy rock scandal of January, February this year. So, essentially, it is a very strong move towards new assertiveness in the role of Russia as energy superpower, which tries to dictate its vision of the world to others, not with nuclear weapons, although they are still there, and the army is gradually revived, as well as the weapon system. But essentially, it is our own business what happens at home, in Chechnya, in the army, in prisons, with racial and ethnic minorities, and so on and so forth. So it is, for us as human rights advocates, it's a complete retreat from fundamental human rights treaties and standards and principles, Helsinki Accord of 1975, the Vienna Conference of 1993, that made it very clear that human rights are not a domestic matter. It is a matter of concern for international community. So that's first. And your second question is central to our work. I'm sure Tanya also has something to say about it, but for us, our major problem is not President Putin or the Russian government, even not the very compromised track record of the United States in human rights. But apathy, as you said, and lack of public support and initiative in civic responsibility and building democracy. Making democracy work for ordinary Russians, making it valuable for ordinary Russians is what we are working hard for. It is difficult. So it should be on the daily level. When it comes from the level of international politics, being really brainwashed by the state-controlled media, they really think that it is not real. It is all about anti-Russian policy of the Western states. And it should be really coming at the level of schools, at the level of communities, at the level of workplace, and they're dealing with the services provided by the government and so on. And that's what we are learning to do through organization of numerous discussions, small projects on the grounds, and so on, although it's getting more and more difficult.
Right. Certainly, as I have already said, our main challenge is how to inspire the Russian public with the ideas of democracy, how to use that on the national level, particularly in the conditions when our access to media is almost nil. That's a very difficult task. But I think that in this situation, really, the community of democratic states has to demonstrate unanimous solidarity with the Russian civil society and with the efforts launched by the Russian civil society. This type of solidarity is incredibly important on the level of official rhetoric, which is promoted very much among the Russian public and is adopted to a large extent by the Russian public, it is being emphasized that human rights and democracy are particular Western values which are foreign to us, which are strange to us. Russia has its own way, and those they are being exported forcefully into the Russian Federation, and those foreign governments that are promoting the concepts of human rights and democracy in Russia are not trying to help Russia, but are actually promoting their own very selfish and very concrete political interests. And I think that the remedy in this situation is indeed in the solidarity of the community of democratic states in support of the Russian civil society. I remember there was an article published by a Soviet dissenter years ago, which was called The Strength of the Dissenters. And in that article, the author argued that the reason why 8 people actually found sufficient inner strength to walk out into the Red Square in protest of the Russian invasion into Czechoslovakia when the Russian tanks entered Prague was because those people realized very clearly that behind them, behind their back, there are all their supporters from London, from Paris, from Washington, and that's what gave them the strength. And I think that if we have that support today, and if locally developed initiatives are supported by the Western democratic community, then we really have a chance. But to stress again, this community of democratic states has to be in that together. If it's only United States, it's not going to work. The U.S. really has to work with the Europeans, develop one single policy, and stick to this policy. That's important. And with regard to concrete programs which would promote democracy in Russia, I think at this point it's really important to focus on the youth. Different education programs, exchanges, professional exchanges, fellowships, doing things to actually broaden the horizons of the younger generation in Russia, to teach them what democracy is all about, to teach them that democracy is not a bad thing and that in Russia it will work.
That's one reason why we like surveys, because it helps us understand how the Russian public thinks about issues, and then it can be useful to activists who are trying to reach that public. There was a man over here who, yes, and then...
I actually had a very similar question as Lubia's last question, but let me just be a bit more specific. These three events that Yuri described that are taking place, given the opportunity of the G8 meeting, clearly to mobilize the international community. My question is, how specifically will these events mobilize Russian civil society, if in fact that's really the challenge, given the restrictions on media? I mean, will they know about it? How will they receive it, et cetera? Thanks very much.
Well, internet is still with us, although shrinking too, a little bit. Well, Russian civil society is fairly well connected through the internet networks and numerous webs of seminars, conferences, roundtables. I must say, for example, that Pamphilova's Civil Jade event has already almost 2,000 applications for participation. Similarly, with the Human Rights Conference, we have little resources and we didn't plan for any huge forum, but we have a tremendous interest. So I do not expect that we will be saying something terribly new there. But what is important is that it will be put in the context of the situation when Russia is at the helm of the most democratic nations club. Kremlin calling. Well, civil society will know. It already knows. It has taken some time. We started slow because of differences. And they are still there, this difference. It's not... It's a project in the making. We are building coalitions. We are overcoming mistrust. We fight over dates, over audiences. Should we invite the left parties? Should we invite the modest nationalists? Should we invite foreign government officials or only experts and media and parliamentarians? These are all big questions which matter, because the jihad will come and go, and we will stay and live in Russia. And it depends a lot on what will be said, who will say, and what is really the message.
And I think it's a very good exercise for the Russian civil society. There are different platforms in which you can express your opinion, and it's up to you to make your choices. And you need to learn to accept that some of your colleagues are thinking differently. Some of us are really active in the civil G8 and Yuri's organizations, my organization, are among those groups. Some of us are active with the other Russia conference, and my organization in particular, we are not part of that process simply because we are not cooperating with the civic congress. We don't think that their way is the right way, but we perfectly accept and support our colleagues who are part of this process,
like
them and like many others. And as far as the Human Rights Conference is concerned, I think that this is the place where we can all come together and stick strictly to the human rights issue and promote our common platform. And we are learning to accept different opinions. We are learning to cooperate with the notion that there is no full consensus among us, that different ways are possible and different ways are meaningful.
We have a long list, so I'm going to ask people to ask their questions crisply, and we'll respond crisply.
Asta Benonis with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. You mentioned that the Civil G8 conference done by the president's office will be a global human rights congress. Does that mean that the G7 are bringing NGOs with them? And have you seen the list of these NGOs, and are they actually gongos? Are they there to cheer Mr. Putin?
Well, first of all, a correction. The Civil G8 is not organized by the president's office. Civil G8 is organized by the International Advisory Committee of 50 NGO people from across the globe, including some professional G8 watchers that have been with the process for many years. It's their work. And some NGOs that live outside of the G8 process, like Civicus, like us, and like Greenpeace, Oxfam, WWF, and others. And there is a smaller national working group of 10 people. So these are the people who decide. Of course, since Ms. Panfilova sits in the president's office, or rather, kind of sits in the president's office, there is influence on her, but not on us. And I must tell you that when we define in this national working group agenda and list of issues, she asks us to be always considerate of not making this event a politicized event and Russia bashing. It should be, she keeps bringing us to the understanding or requests that we understand and remember that we should be at this process addressing global issues that are of importance to all G8 and beyond, not just about Russia. So far, there have been some gongos on the Russian side. We cannot, we are on the sort of the same playing field. We are competing with them. They have some advantages to us, but extra support, but we have our own advantages too.
What about G7 gongos? I mean, how democratic are these Western?
Well, I must say that by the way, the second correction, it's not only Human Rights Forum. There'll be many other issues on the table as well. There are parallel sections there, including the environment, the energy issues, the health, education, and so on and so forth, like 10 of them, of which 4 will be human rights, which is a major thing for us. We are quite happy. So we invite real people. We invite Human Rights Watch. We invite Amnesty. We invite, sorry?
And they're coming.
And they're coming. And they're coming. Human Rights First. Our colleagues from International Helsinki Federation, from different G7 countries, and not only G7, other countries as well. So there might show up some people who are coming sort of not invited by us, but we don't know.
Well, let's put it this way. We are basically guaranteed that we can't, for the human rights roundtables, and we cannot be responsible for anything else, granted. But for those roundtables, we can put together our own list of participants. We are also putting together the list of foreign experts, those colleagues that we are inviting from abroad. And we are guaranteed that the documents of the roundtables, which are going to be passed on to the G8 leadership, are not going to be censored at all. And in my opinion, on the one hand, if those guarantees are breached, it's never too late to slam the door. And that's, if we have to slam the door in this situation with all the coverage that the civil G8 is definitely going to get, because the President's office is actually interested in publicizing it as much as possible, that shall be very scandalous. But another point which I would like to make is that when, for example, my organization and the Memorial Human Rights Center and the both groups are very much Chechnya and Northern Caucasus focused, we're approached with a suggestion to put together a roundtable on terrorism, anti-terrorism, and armed conflicts. When we were thinking about it, and we had our doubts initially, I wouldn't hide that, but first of all, we decided that it would be not an intelligent move to ignore this platform when we actually knew for certain that our documents, the way we draft them, are going to be transmitted to the G8 leadership. But another point which was very important for us is that for once we actually have a chance to express solidarity with our colleagues from international human rights organizations, from human rights groups and civic society groups here in the United States, in the UK, in other countries of the G7. Because usually they come to us and work for us and focus on our issues, and we are completely Russia-focused, but we knew the kind of problems that are so relevant here in the US, and this is our chance to speak our mind and to discuss these problems with our colleagues. And that's a big motivation for us. This is the one thing that personally makes me do that.
Vandenberg, I'm an attorney in private practice. I have 2 questions. Tanya, you've alluded several times to the situation in Chechnya, and I wondered if you could give us a snapshot of the situation in Chechnya now and let us know what you think the message should be to the G8. That's the first question. And the second is, the other small outpouring of outrage in the Russian Federation that we've seen lately is over the botched investigation, over the botched case of Beslan. And I'm wondering if that outrage about the Beslan situation and the report is widespread or whether it's narrowly just really among the families.
Right, thank you for asking me a Chechnya question. In fact, for the past several years, I've been working on the situation in Chechnya very intensively, and now I'm there in the Republic every couple of months or so. Frankly, the situation is scary. It's incredibly scary because after so many years of bloodshed, after all that suffering and so many lives destroyed, we basically came back to the reference point. I see pretty much no difference between what Chechnya is today and what it used to be between the two wars. Very chaotic, completely out of control, very criminal entity, lawless, absolutely lawless. And the main difference, I guess, between what we see in Chechnya today and what was there between the two wars in the middle 90s is that at that time, it was a self-proclaimed, quasi-independent state, and it was accountable for its wrongdoings. It was not internationally recognized, but it was certainly accountable for its wrongdoings. Now it's a full-fledged subject of the Russian Federation, and it's the Russian Federation which has the accountability. At the same time, what we now see on international level, at different international fora, whenever Russian officials are approached with concerns about Chechnya, say abductions in Chechnya, torture in Chechnya, and that certainly happens on a regular basis, particularly in process of the human rights consultations between the Russian Federation and the European Union, the Russian officials are saying, well, it's not us, it's the Kadyrovtsy. It's the local enforcers now that are mainly responsible for the abductions, that are mainly responsible for torture. We are not accountable. And I think that the position of the United States on that issue and the position of the European Union on this issue has to be very clear. You are accountable for the impunity. Those forces are your creatures. They are subjugated to you. Apparently, at the last round of the human rights consultations in Vienna, when the Russian delegation was asked questions about Ramzan Kadyrov and his politics, they simply retorted that Ramzan Kadyrov was a very young and inexperienced politician and should not be paid attention to. But Ramzan Kadyrov, ironically enough, just 2 days previously had been appointed prime minister of the republic. And I think that in those situations, it is essential that the United States and the European Union actually call the bluff. These are new developments on Chechnya, and I think it's important for you to understand this. Today, we do see some reconstruction. There are actually visible changes in Grozny and in the rest of the republic. And not even the harshest critic of Ramzan Kadyrov can deny that. You see things changing. You see things happening. However, whatever's happening in Chechnya, be that positive or negative, is happening completely outside of the legal framework. For example, with the reconstruction process, it is partly funded by kickback money. And everyone is aware of that. But the kickback system is structured in a very logical fashion. It is the business community which pays the most. Then come the policemen and other such officials. Then the teachers and doctors, and they really pay the list, just trifles. But everyone has to contribute.
Social justice.
Because at the same time, people don't even protest against it. Because for someone who's been unemployed for about 10 years, and the unemployment in Chechnya is over 70% officially, even if the real unemployment is probably over 80%, he goes like, well, I've been without a job for 10 years. This policeman, he gets 15,000 rubles a month. It would not hurt him to contribute 3,000 rubles out of that so that they would build a park where my children could play. And on the level of the law enforcement and how the law enforcement comports itself, it's also completely lawless. There are secret prisons. People are being detained. They're being tortured, and they confess, and only then their detention is actually processed officially. It's a parallel reality which exists outside of the legal framework, and it's incredibly frightening. What's particularly frightening from the security point of view that the way I see, there has been a certain consensus found between the public at large in Chechnya and the authorities. And that consensus is strictly anti-federal. Ramzan Kadyrov actually allows people in Chechnya to go out into the streets and rally if there is a crime perpetrated by a federal serviceman. He allows the people, he encourages the people who come out in the streets and have a rally if Moscow has not delivered sufficient budget to Chechnya. Because after all, Moscow is responsible for all the ruination. They have to keep quiet about Kadyrov himself and his militarized units. That goes without saying. But they can't speak up about Moscow, and they do that. So if you view that in combination with what Ramzan Kadyrov defines as federal Sharia, that is ban on alcohol, an order to women to have their head covered. Now, if you watch Chechen TV, if you watch the Chechen news, you see that all the anchors wear kerchiefs. It wasn't there before. It wasn't there like 4 months ago. Now it's happening.
It's about $1,000.
Right. Ramzan Kadyrov, it's like an anecdotal thing, but Ramzan Kadyrov held a conference for Chechen students in Grozny. Students were taken to that conference on buses. He walked into the conference hall, looked around, and made a gift of $1,000 in cash to every girl who was wearing a headscarf. This happened just a few months ago, and it's a fact. It's not just gossip. It's not just rumor. So when these things are happening and they're being encouraged, it's really incredibly scary. And you can hear people in Chechnya speaking about Ramzan Kadyrov in a different manner than, say, a year ago. Now many are saying, well, no matter how cruel he is, no matter how brutal he is a real boss, he is a real Chechen, he is a real man. At least he has the capacity to do something. He's so popular because he's distinctly, on the local level, distinctly anti-federal. And he uses it. He's got some very smart public relations advice. The problem is that for Russia, Chechnya is not a priority today. The Northern Caucasus, despite the terrible spillout of the conflict, is not a priority today. They're just keeping the lid shut over the boiling pot, and they are ready to give Ramzan Kadyrov anything to pacify him, you know, to prevent an explosion before 2008, because our politics today are completely focused on 2008. And that's a great tragedy, really. Particularly, Ramzan Kadyrov is already prime minister. His next ambition is the presidency. What comes next? He's young. He's ambitious. And what comes next? Beslan, well, I think that the Beslan trial is really very much a subject of debate in the Northern Caucasus, but not so much on the mainland. It's been going on for a very long time, and the mainstream public in Russia, to a great extent, lost interest. But in the Northern Caucasus, it's one of the key issues, and that's why, actually, the deputy prosecutor of the Russian Federation demanded death penalty for the only person who is on trial now, Kulayev. He thinks that by demanding a death penalty, he sends a very strong signal, and he's going to pacify all those people in North Ossetia who are discontent and who want to see other people on trial, particularly those who are responsible for letting this happen. Well, first of all, they're not going to be satisfied. Secondly, with Russia just becoming chair of the Council of Europe, I don't think it's a good idea for such a high-level public official to actually demand death sentence. Because according to our obligations, accession obligations, before the Council of Europe, we have to eliminate death penalty altogether.
We have, I want to remind everybody, we have about 3 minutes. So quick questions and quick responses.
Okay, my question will be very, very quick. First of all, dobro pozdravljam to both of you, and thank you for your very eloquent presentations. I just have to ask you a follow-up question, Tanya, regarding this $1,000 gift, which I've heard about before, and what this means analytically from your perspective regarding Kadyrov and his appeal on religious grounds. Is this an effort to compete with Basayev? Give us your analysis of what this means.
Very quickly, there have been some Russians who have spoken here in Washington the past couple months from the civil society public chamber, as I believe it's being called, including a member. I would just, they insist that they have been working very hard to defend civil society from the Duma, from the excesses of the Kremlin. I would just like a response to the, your opinion on that.
Ramzan Kadyrov, when he's banning alcohol, when he's introducing his federal Sharia, when he's making sure that women actually wear headscarves, he's indeed trying to gain some popularity, and to a certain extent it works. He's trying to demonstrate to the public in Chechnya that he's a real Chechen leader, that he's for the traditional value, the values, that he's for the religious values, and that he will make sure that Chechnya lives by its own laws. The federal legislation does not quite matter. Even if Chechnya is not formally independent, Ramzan Kadyrov is trying to demonstrate that under his rule, Chechnya can exist as almost an independent entity, at the same time milking Kremlin for the money.
Two things. Public chamber is a fake. It's a moulage. It's not a real thing. Secondly, there are some good people there. Very few, 5, 10, maybe. They were outraged by the fact that even when they were appointed by the president and were supposedly supposed to be treated as the civil society, they were not consulted with when the law was adopted. So that was the main point. And we tried to use it, although we, the independents, do not work with the civic chamber, with the public chamber. We, at the same time, work with some individuals there, trying to use the some of the channels and capacities, because we have fewer and fewer channels. And in January, when the law was already passed in the parliament, but not yet signed by the president, and even a little before that in December, we supported some of the people in the public chamber who were outraged and wanted to write a letter and make public statements, and we were quite happy about that. But later on, when the president signed, the law came into force, they were all saying, well, the law was amended, it's much better, it's fine, no problem. And they were repeating the same mantra that the Duma and the Kremlin were repeating, which is, well, the law is, you know, very much in line with the international experiences, with what happens in other countries. So it's over. It's gone. Public chamber, it was a small episode, mainly driven by their own, disappointment that they are not taken seriously. They thought they were not a toy.
As you leave, I want to remind you that there are lots of papers on Chechnya, police, other issues. Please join me in thanking this hero and heroine, God and Goddess. Thanks a lot.